So I'm going to be picking up the question that that Claudia asked last night about organ donation. Turns out to be complicated enough that I've added a bunch of material. I don't know about, yeah, it's a bunch. And so it's, if you have the handout, and if you don't have a handout, they're on the little table in the back. There are going to be three slides worth of material that are not on the handout. So, and I didn't really leave any place for you to add anything to the handout, so I'm not sure what you're going to do. The margins, maybe. I'd like to start in Philippians 1. Paul is considering his condition, and he says, "Yes, I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account." So Paul is saying that if it were up to me, I would go to be with Jesus, but I have work to do. And last night we were talking about the choices that we make ultimately are choices about what Jesus would have us do with our energy and our time and our bodies. And Paul follows that line of reasoning in his letter to the Philippians. I have to decide what to do. If I were serving myself, it would be fine with me if my life were to end. But it's not up to me. It's more necessary that I be available to serve you. And so Paul goes on to talk about Jesus' provision for him. Well, first about Jesus' laying down his own glory for the sake of us. So there's a kind of, the master that we serve is not the typical taskmaster who sits back, leaves all the nasty work for his servants, and just basks in the comfort and the glory of being the master. But Jesus is the kind of master, this connects with where we began, Jesus is the kind of shepherd who provides abundant life for us and then lays down his life in order to accomplish our redemption. But Paul's argument in Philippians is the same thing. Jesus asks service of him, but Jesus had laid down the glory of heaven in order to become incarnate, in order to accomplish our redemption. Moses' last days, that's the picture is an attempt. I realize the man in the picture is not dressed like Moses. I couldn't find somebody looking out over a vista like that from a great height, dressed in a desert garb. But that's what I wanted. I just couldn't find one. In Deuteronomy 34, we read of the death of Moses. And it can't be written by Moses. Well, I suppose it could have been written in a 100% prophecy of his own death, but the tradition is that it was Joshua who wrote the end of Deuteronomy, and we have an account of Moses' last days. It's a striking picture. Both there's a sadness to it, because Moses had led the people out of Egypt, and when they get to the very edge of the promised land, they're at the river Jordan, they're about to go, the whole people is about to go into the land of Canaan that has been promised, well, promised first to their parents who rebelled in the desert, and so God punished them by saying, you're not going to get to enter the promised land, but your children will. So they wandered for 40 years, and now their children are about to go into the promised land, and Moses doesn't get to go with them because Moses didn't follow God's instructions the second time water came from the rock. The first time, God said, strike the rock, and the water came rushing out. The second time, the Lord's command to Moses was, speak to the rock, and Moses struck it, And he's told, and we're told of this in Hebrews as well, we're told that it's because he struck the rock the second time that he's not allowed to enter Canaan. So even though he's led the people through the desert forever and ever and put up with the danger of leading them out of Israel, he's not allowed to go into the promised land. And God takes him up onto Mount Nebo, and he sees Canaan, having told, you don't get to go in. And then it says that Moses dies, and he dies with his eye undimmed and his vigor unabated. He's fully healthy and has all his faculties, and God takes him there on Mount Nebo. And later in the book of James, there's a reference to a struggle for the body of Moses between Satan and Michael. All right, really, the fair amount of magical mythology caught up in that question. It's one of the reasons Jude deals with it. But the picture is striking because God takes Moses even though Moses is fully healthy. And one of the things we learn from that is that God doesn't need any of our strength. God's going to make use of what we have, and when he's done with us, he's going to take, in Moses' case, he goes to be with the Lord. It's not, we shouldn't feel bad for Moses. He goes from looking at the promised land, the earthly promised land, to the actual promised land. So it isn't like God said, this is your punishment, is you get to see the promised land and now you're into oblivion. Moses goes from seeing the physical promised land to realizing the real promised land, but he still has strength, but his mission is done. Helpful to remember. God wants all of us, and when God's ready to use other people, then it'll be time for that. I want to talk a little bit about my dad. I had been working on this is the only internet picture of my father, as far as I can tell, and I looked. It's a little town newspaper in extreme north central Washington state, 4 miles from the Canada border. So picture Washington state, picture the middle and go to the Canadian border. And like, it's not nowhere, but you can see nowhere from there. but he had, it's where he retired, and so he could fish and do some other things. And so they got a picture of him in the local paper, and it's the only picture there is of him. And my dad was as camera shy as people get, as in camera phobic, like take your camera from you and crush it kind of thing, not happy if you take a picture of him. So having a picture of him is really nice. He died 4 years ago. So in the spring of 2014, the Covenant College gave me a sabbatical to work on end-of-life decision-making and the biblical principles that inform it. So I had a semester without teaching duties, and so I had a chance to do reading that I wouldn't have had a chance to do otherwise. I could travel a bit and meet with intensive care people in different cities. I rode around with a hospice chaplain. I learned more about what it looks like to make these decisions with real people rather than reading about them. And I had put together, over the course of that semester and through these interviews, I'd put together the basic outline and had started writing the chapters for the book. And then one of the principal ways that I prepared for the book is I put together a Sunday school curriculum and taught it to two different churches. And it's a 4-week series. The whole curriculum is available as a free download from Presbyterian Reformed from their website. But I was road testing this Sunday school material. And for the fourth weekend, and it was the weekend, this is the Sunday school class where it's the big finish, right? It's the fourth of four, and the thing I do is I bring the advanced directive form like the one that we looked at last night, if you were here. I bring the advance directive form, and then I say, we're going to fill it out right now, and we're going to sign each other's. That was the plan. So I'm walking into the room where I'm going to teach this Sunday school class, and my cell phone goes off, and it's a hospital in Wenatchee, Washington, which is a two-hour drive from where my dad lives. And my dad has been taken to this hospital by ambulance, a two-hour ambulance ride. So he had had, he was in a wheelchair. He was limited to a wheelchair, but he was transferring from the wheelchair to another chair, and he slipped. The transfer turns out to be a big deal. Once you're wheelchair-ridden, that process of getting from the wheelchair to the bed, from the wheelchair to other chairs like that, that's a dangerous time. And he was fairly heavy, and he fell and got wedged between the chair and the wall and he called for help, but nobody heard him, and he tried to lift himself on his own, and we learned later, badly tore his rotator cuff in his shoulder, trying to lift himself. I mean, when you're in distress, you ask your body to do things it probably can't do. And so he'd done that, but he didn't know that. He didn't know he tore the rotator cuff, and now he has all of the symptoms of a heart attack, which he's had before. So he's had a heart attack before, but now he's got intense pain right here, right arm, sweating, short of breath, calls for the ambulance. And they come and they take him, and because he'd had a recent heart event and he was clearly in pain, they didn't think there was any local hospital that could handle him, and they drove him 2 hours to Wenatchee, and that's when they call me. That was a Sunday. He would die Friday morning. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but so there's all these questions. What to do. And I call this the final exam for my sabbatical. Dean, did you have sabbaticals? There are those. Did you take one? No. You never took one. Okay. You should have. Since I've been working on this question, well, part of working on the question, I've been talking to my dad. So, Dad, what do you want done when you're in the hospital and somebody has to make decisions for you? And we'd gone through the whole thing. And he had decided that he didn't want to be resuscitated if his heart quit. He didn't want to be intubated. He didn't want the tube down his throat if he needed assistance breathing. He was ready to go be with Jesus. That would be fine. He just didn't want those things. So he was, but when the hospital went to his house and took him, they didn't take the document with them. So he's going to a new hospital, not the one that has his advance directive. All he can do is he remembers my number, and so they call. So they don't have the documents, but he told me about them. This was the key. I didn't have to guess what my dad wanted. Really looks like he needs to be, a lot of assistance with breathing. We've got him on the cannula, the thing under your nose. You can pull from pure oxygen. We've got him on that, but he needs more than that. We would like to intubate him to find out what's going on. And I said, what should we do? And I said, I remember. We talked about it. Do not intubate. Okay, good. Really? I said, yeah, everything you can do except put a tube down his throat, he's okay with. So they gave him a mask and put him on that. And he rallied, and he was able to say, yes, that's what I wanted. That's good. That's what I wanted. But then he started declining. Well, all of the attention is on his heart, but it turns out he hadn't had a heart event. He'd torn his rotator cuff. But what they discovered, the reason he's having trouble breathing, what didn't have anything to do with his heart, is that he had a softball-sized mass in his right lung that had never been caught by anyone. So, and he'd been a career naval officer on submarines. He'd smoked. Just being on a submarine will give you emphysema. Smoking for most of that time will make it much worse. So he's got that, and he's got pneumonia. So he's got the top half of his right lung has got a mass in it. The bottom half of his right lung is full of liquid, and the rest of his lungs are riddled with emphysema. Like, he's in trouble. So he starts declining, and his children get to him. I got there on Thursday. My twin brother and I live on the East Coast, and we got there by Thursday night. And he's now declined to the point that he's had the mask on for 5 days, and he hasn't slept, really, for 5 days. Every time he goes to sleep, a machine wakes him up or something happens. So he's like frantic for lack of sleep, if you know what, I hope you have no idea what I'm talking about, but you might. He hasn't slept, and the mask has been on for 5 days, and those masks are wonderful for giving you oxygen, but they're super dehydrating, and so his mouth was cracked and bleeding all around. So it was painful, even with the pain medicine they were giving him, because he didn't want to be intubated, and that's what he still didn't want it. Well, when we got there, he was foggy. And the new hospitalist, this was, even in Wenatchee, the hospital wasn't big enough to have an intensive care unit. So they just had ordinary, their highest functioning beds, but there wasn't somebody who was a specialist in intensive medicine. They just had specialists in hospital care. And so this doctor went in and spent about 30 seconds trying to talk to him, came out and said, I don't think he can answer any questions. I wasn't real happy with this guy. And he said, so you're going to have to decide. I said, I can't wake him up. But I'd watched him try, and it wasn't a serious effort. So I went and I said, okay, so I'm happy to answer your questions. I know what he wants because we've talked about it. So what's the decision that you need? He said, well, here's where we are. We know that he doesn't want to be intubated, and I guess that makes sense. But what we need to know is whether there's any point in keeping him on the mask. If we keep him on the mask, he'll live maybe 6 days, maybe 6 weeks, but probably 6 days. And if we take him off the mask and make him comfortable, he'll sleep, and he might live 6 hours or a week. What would he want? Does he want... I said, well, I know the one question he would want answered, and that is he ever going to leave the hospital? And he said, no, he's never going to leave the hospital. Now, I didn't just have this doctor's opinion. There's a palliative care doctor, a specialist in pain management, was the first person I called on Sunday after I got off the phone. I called the front desk of the hospital. I said, is there a palliative care doctor in town who has privileges at the hospital? And they gave me a name of somebody. I called him, and he was fantastic. The great thing about somebody who was a consult. He became a consultant to my dad's case, which meant because he had privileges at the hospital, he could read his whole chart, and he could say, all right, I've seen the big picture. The cardiologist says his heart is fine. The pulmonologist says he has no real hope of leaving the hospital. Like his kidneys are having trouble, so those doctors say this. But this palliative care doc read the whole thing, and he said, here's what you need to know. He's never going to leave the hospital. Certainly, and I said, can we pray that he will get better anyway? He said, well, of course. Now, I don't think this doc was a believer, but he said, of course you can pray. All kinds of things happen. So we prayed that he would be restored, but he wasn't. So, but this doctor said he's never going to leave the hospital. There aren't machines that he can take home that would keep him alive there. I said, I'm pretty sure that's what he cares about. If the machines aren't ever going to make him strong enough to go home, because that's the only thing he said. He says, the only thing he ever asked me on the phone was, how long am I going to be here? How long before I can go home? And I would say, palliative care doc says, not going to happen. He said, I really want to make that happen. So now that I had two doctors who said, you're never going to leave the hospital, I told my dad. So I woke him up, and I said, we have to talk about something really difficult. And he threw okay. I said, the doctors say you're never going to leave the hospital. And you could just see, there's a whole lot you can say with just your eyes. And this was like shoulder slump. I said, so we have to make a choice. Do you want to stay on all of these machines and this mask, and you may live a week or 6 weeks at the most, but you have to have the mask on the whole time. And you probably won't sleep much. Or we can take the mask off, make you comfortable, alter the medicines that they're giving you. So they weren't giving him the kind of morphine he needed to control his pain, because that suppresses breathing. So when you're having trouble breathing, morphine isn't part of curing you. But when you're trying to stay comfortable, morphine is part of keeping you comfortable, even though it's going to make it harder to breathe. Or at least it lowers the anxiety that makes you want to breathe. That's the connection that does it. So I said, I think based on all that we've talked about, that you would like to be kept comfortable. Is that what you want? And he pulled himself back up, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, yes. It was the last word he said, but it meant that I didn't make the decision, which is an enormous relief. I don't have to wonder, did I give up on him? Did I do this too soon? I laid it out for him, and he made the choice. Now, I'm pretty sure that that's exactly what he would have chosen if he was as strong as he'd ever been and as clear thinking as he's ever been, because we'd talked about it. So I don't think I was just guessing. No, I know I wasn't just guessing, but I had this confirmation. And then what happened after that was amazing. It isn't that he stood up and walked around. That would have been amazing. So they changed the order from aggressive cure, and they made the plan, the goal, to keep him comfortable. So they turned off the machines, and they gave him a morphine drip, and the palliative care doctor stayed in the room for 45 minutes while they increased the dose just to the point where he wasn't uncomfortable, but he was still breathing strongly. And you have to do it very carefully, but the literature says, the studies say, that as long as there's a pain specialist who's being careful, you won't overdo the morphine and be the reason that they stop breathing for good. So this pain specialist was willing to stay there and up the dose, watch for 15 minutes to see if there's any signs of pain. And he was talking the whole time saying, here's what we're looking for. Oh, did you see that? So there was just a little twitch of his arm. He said, okay, he's still in pain. He needs more. Or there was a little grimace, just like, did you see that? I said, no, I didn't see that. He said, well, so he was watching for it. So I was really glad there was somebody who was an expert in pain management. It offended the other doctor that there was another doctor involved in the case, but I don't care. And you shouldn't either. Like, doctors have feelings too, but the best care is the best care. And then he slept. For the first time in days, he slept for real. And my brother and I were having a conversation. We were still in the room, but we were like, he was about that far away, about 6 feet away. My dad was about six feet away. And my brother and I were talking, and we've been talking for an hour and a half or so. And my brother says, Dad's still breathing? So we went over to the bed, and we saw, and then we're watching. 30 seconds later, said, so we're, at, when we started talking, he was breathing about 16 times a minute. Now he's down to two. So I went and I got a nurse, and the nurse, who was 12 years old, as far as I can tell, really young nurse. I'm sure she was older than 12. But the nurse came in the room, and she looked very serious, and she got down close to his face, and she stared at the clock, and like 30 seconds, she checked his pulse, 30 seconds, no pulse. She checked for breathing, 30 seconds, no breathing. She checked his pupils, and then she stood up, and she said, he has passed. And I'm pretty sure it was her first time declaring somebody dead. He has passed. And he looked like he was asleep. He just wasn't moving. And I had never seen a dead body before. I was afraid of dead bodies at viewings. I was just like, I don't know. I'd never seen it. But this was remarkably peaceful, that he'd gotten there, and he wasn't in pain anymore, and he was with Jesus. And it was beautiful. And one of the last things he told us was, so when I go, there's a card in my wallet. That's all he said. So after he was dead, my brother remembered that. I'd forgotten. He said, there's a card in his wallet. And we pulled it out. It was a card from the Neptune Society. Dad had been paying $2 a month for like 30 years for the Neptune Society to take his body and bury him at sea. He was a naval officer. That's what he wanted. And all the card said was, call this number. So we called this number, and the nice person in the Neptune Society said, oh, yes, your dad's paid in full. What's the address of the hospital? And that was it. They took care of all the death certificates. It was really wonderful that my dad had planned that out so that we didn't have to figure out, now what do we do with the body, and how do we make this legal, and how do we... They contacted the insurance companies. They did everything. That was a really nice thing. So I had to make all kinds of choices, although it wasn't hard because my dad had given me instructions about what he wanted done. And so if there's a takeaway from what I've done this weekend, it's that you would take that step and figure out what you want and explain it to your children. Figure out a way to explain it to them where they won't cry and leave the room and that kind of thing. The last thing on this slide is about a time-limited trial. And it wasn't appropriate or needed in my dad's case, but this is the language that hospitals now use for families that are having, when it's just not clear, what should we discontinue the aggressive pursuit of a cure, of restoration, or should we shift from making the goal restoration to making the goal comfort? How do we know? And so this has just been in the last 5 years that the medical community is comfortable with saying the medical people, the doctors and the nurses, are looking at just a handful of key indicators, something about the shape of the heart rhythm, something, and then these output having to do with kidney function and your blood oxygen saturation that's measured. I'm doing this because there's a thing they put on your finger to measure blood oxygen saturation. So there's a handful, 3 to 5 key numbers that doctors and nurses are all looking at to determine, is it likely that they're going to recover, or are we managing their comfort as they die? And so what the family can do is they say, we would like you to tell us what you're looking at over the next 48 hours. Tell us, what are the key numbers, and what should we be looking for? So if the blood oxygen saturation is currently 89%, which is not great, 89%, if that's going to improve to 93% over the next 48 hours, that would be a good sign that the person's going to recover. But if it's going to just stay the same or even decline, that's a really good sign that they're not. And so different doctors have different preferences about what numbers matter most. And you ask the doctor, can we do a time-limited trial? And the doctor said, just tell us 3 numbers that we can watch on the machines in here. And it gives the family something to look at, like, because the doctors aren't around a lot. You should keep a list of the questions you want to ask them when they show up. But the doctors can say, we're looking at that number, and that number over there, and we want that one to go up this far, and this one not to get any worse, and this one to go up that much. And then every time you wonder, what are we going to do, you look at the numbers rather than just trying to figure out, is he looking stronger or not? This allows the family to keep track of what the doctors are keeping track of anyway. And it means there's almost certainly not going to be an argument. You're going to know, really, halfway in, you're going to know, oh, this is not getting better. It's getting worse. But it also gives everybody a chance to adjust to the idea that we've reached the end of what medicine can do. And often that's the hardest part, is just accepting that medicine can't change where this is going. And so sometimes the family would just say, do everything, because really they're just not ready to accept that medicine can't do anything. And so asking for a time-limited trial is something doctors and nurses are comfortable with, and it makes it easier for everyone. Makes it, you know, they keep statistics on everything in the hospital. It makes a disagreement at the end of the 48 or 72 hours, it makes a disagreement about what ought to be done dramatically less likely. So it's not giving up. It's saying, help us understand what you, the medical professionals, are looking at. Just before I went out to be with my dad as he died, there was an ethics committee meeting at the hospital where I volunteer. So I went to the meeting and I described what was happening to my dad, and the director of the intensive care unit after the meeting said, come with me. And he took me up to an empty ICU room with all the machines set up to receive someone. He said, probably there will be machines like these where your dad is being taken care of. This is the number on this machine. He turned them all on. He said, this is the number on this machine that you care about. All the rest of this is just whether it's working right. That number. He went to each of the machines and he said, you want the numbers to be in this range and getting better. I'm taking notes on what all these machines mean. And when I got to the hospital room where my dad was, most of the machines were made by the same company with monitors, you know, numbers in exactly the places I'd been told to look. And so I knew within 3 minutes of getting in the room, this is not good. But it's because this intensive care doctor took the time. So, and the doctors will, the nurses, the doctors probably don't have time to explain the machines to you, but the nurses will. Nurse comes in, you can say, can you help me understand this machine? It beeps. What does the beep mean? Well, nothing. It beeps to make sure we all know that it's on. Oh, sometimes it beeps and it means something. So the nurses will explain to you what the various machines mean. All right, I got to answer Claudia's question about organ donation. So when I started volunteering at ethics committees at hospitals, I was not an organ donor. I was not an organ donor because I don't trust people to protect my life when my organs look juicy. I'd seen enough episodes of ER. By the way, medical dramas on television are about the worst place possible to find out what actually happens in the hospital, because their goal is to make it look exciting. And most of what happens in the hospital is grindingly boring, except for moments of extreme terror. And there's the romances that are going on in the closet are not going on in the closet. Those sorts of things. So it's not a good, and the worst thing to learn about on TV is what happens when they try to restart your heart, you know, clear that thing. They've done an audit. 60% of the people who get resuscitated with the paddles in the hospital recover and leave the hospital to go home on TV. In reality, it's under 3%, unless your heart stops when you're in the cardiac cath lab, because they probably made it happen. It was, you know, they just got too close to the edge, and you probably were fine. But if you're anywhere else in the hospital other than the cardiac care unit, where they're the testing limits of what your heart can do, if your heart stops, you got a 3% chance of it restarting and you ever leaving the hospital. Now, the chances that your heart will restart and you'll go back to being unconscious or whatever you were is over 10%, just a bit over 10%. But that you'll ever leave the hospital is like 3. So this is the only doctor joke I know. Where do you want to be if your heart stops? On TV. That's it. That's my only joke. So I had learned about medical care from watching television, and that's a terrible place to learn about medical care. The reality is complicated. Organ donation is a fantastic thing. There are people who need organs that you can only get from dead people. Hearts and livers are the big ones. And it used to be hearts and livers full stop, but just recently they've developed a partial liver transplant that allows you to take part of a liver from someone who's alive enough for you to live and enough for them to continue living with their part of a liver. Now, it has to be a super good behaving liver that you're taking it, you know, that you're taking it from. But partial liver transplants, they're brand new in the last year. They've been being tested for years, but they're now available. Hearts are still all or nothing. Lungs are pretty close to all or nothing. The people who need hearts and whole livers and lungs are going to die without them, and people die all the time waiting for a transplant. And so if people who are able to donate organs, that's a wonderful thing to do. Extends lives, all this. And the system for deciding who gets the available organs is really well managed. It's a system that's about expected medical benefit, not about whether you have friends in high places or whether you have lots of money. It's not about that. It really is a money-blind, social connection-blind, medical benefit, super-aware system. So it's not a bad thing to do. Volunteering is a noble thing to do. Families of volunteers. So I'm an organ donor. My Georgia driver's license says organ donor. But the way the law works is, even if my driver's license says organ donor, they can't take my organs until someone alive says you can. Even if it's on your driver's license, they're going to go to my wife or they're going to go to somebody representing me and say, he's an organ donor. Yes? Now, the people they send to talk to your family are really good at getting yes. They're professional. They're like salespeople, but they've got a great product. but they're one of the most common complaints of people whose family members recently died at the hospital where I volunteer is that the organ donation people were pushy. And that it was not what they wanted to talk about. But they are in your lap within minutes of you being declared dead. They are all over you because the best organs for transplant are out of brand new dead bodies, as close as they can get to the moment of your death. So much so that there are states, Ohio's one of them, there are states that allow them, if you have a really strong heart and you've got a massive head injury, that you can, your family, you can't do it because massive head injury means you can't. Your family can make an agreement with the transplant service that they will take you into a place where you're prepped to have your organs taken. The person who's going to, you're still alive. You're seriously unconscious. Your Glasgow coma scale below 5, really out. But you're still alive. They bring in the person who's going to get it, and then they purposely stop your heart. But before they purposely stop your heart, they start injecting you, your bloodstream, with anticoagulants so that it'll be really easy to take your heart heart and liver when the time comes. So you can agree to this. The state of Ohio, the state of Tennessee, the state of Georgia, they all allow this to happen, and the family has to agree. I think this is not okay. Seems to me that it's wrong to, because having anticoagulants put in your system means that you're hurting the person who's about to die. You're doing something to their body that is not for their good, it's for the good of the person who's going to get the organ. And it's called beating heart donor or donation on cardiac death. I'm trying to remember that there's an official name in Ohio, and it's escaping me right now. So what you want to do is, all you have to do is, if you're the family member, you just say, my loved one is willing to be an organ donor, but no changes until they're declared dead. That turns out to be sufficient for this sort of, not quite, yeah. So long as you say, once they're declared dead, you can take them. They know what to do. They can get the organs. So And I think that there are going to be other ways that the law will change where you still want to stick with once they're declared dead. Dealing with donor-provider services. In Tennessee, it's the Tennessee Organ Donor System. I don't remember what it's called in Ohio. But now I want to talk about brain death. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it does. Thank you. That's wrong. Thank you. The slide is incorrect. I remember when I typed that thinking, that sentence seems wrong. But it was between Claudia's question and this morning, so it's a great question. So being an organ donor does not mean that they can just go to your family and say, we've got the card, you have to say yes. They can't do that. About brain death, there's a case in Texas that was on headline news this morning about a girl who has been declared brain dead by the physicians, significantly, crucially for the legal matter, by two physicians. In the state of Texas, if two physicians declare you dead, then the hospital does not have an obligation to continue treatment. The hospital only has an obligation to assist you in finding a hospital that will receive you by transfer. And what was on the news this morning is that 25 hospitals have declined to accept this young girl for transfer. Now, there's a reason that they've declined to accept the girl for transfer. She has a flat EEG. She has zero brain activity. Zero. And there are no cases of people with zero brain activity having brain activity restored, like even from the direct intervention of the Holy Spirit. There haven't been cases of the restoration of in the 1960s, all the stuff about brain death started in the 1960s, and the first standard that they had was called the Harvard criteria, and that was that there would be two flat EEGs 24 hours apart, that you have 24 hours with zero brain activity. And then after that, they would declare you dead. And that would have stayed the standard if there wasn't a serious need for organs by donation. They said, 24 hours of a dead body means that none of those organs are useful. So give us a way, the doctors, and the transplant doctors especially, wanted a way to have death declared without waiting 24 hours for everything to fall apart. And so the current standard, this is biblically sound. I'm satisfied that the irreversible cessation of either heart-lung function or all brain activity, including the brainstem, that's the official definition of death. If you go to any hospital near here and say, we'd like to see your policy defining death, I promise they have one, because otherwise they wouldn't get Medicaid funds. They've got a definition of death, and it looks exactly like that. That's the universal definition of death. There's a most important word, irreversible, like, according to whom? Well, if the Archangel Gabriel's standing next to you saying, that's it, it's not coming back, well, then you would know. But most of us don't have direct access to God's complete timeline into the future. And as a result, this is in the judgment of a physician. And you can always say, I'd like the judgment of another physician. I would like the judgment of a specialist. I would like the judgment of a neurologist. And in the case of this child, you should ask for, and the family did ask for, the judgment of a pediatric neurologist. This is brain function specialist for children. And it was two pediatric neurologists, not in this case. So I don't know for the qualifications of the people who said she was brain dead. But the standard thing to do, and probably what any judge would order, is the judgment of the most qualified specialist you can find. And if two pediatric neurologists told me that my child was brain dead, they're dead in the eyes of the state. And I think that it's appropriate, it's permissible to believe that they're dead in God's eyes too. Now, that doesn't... I think mostly when you see these stories on TV, everything happened so fast. They went from a vital daughter to a brain-dead daughter so fast that they didn't have time to process any of it. And they just want everybody to back off and give them time. Don't say she's dead. We're praying for a miracle. And you certainly pray for them. I think it's appropriate to say that you treat them as dead. So, most states. Texas is one of the most inflexible. Most states, the judges have the power to say, yes, I know you've got the opinion of two specialists, but for the sake of the family, we're going to wait 5 days. We want the hospital to continue care for 5 days, or whatever the judge believes is the appropriate amount of time. And Texas, there's no wiggle room. The Texas legislature wrote the law to keep judges from doing that. And so these cases are much more likely to happen in Texas because the Texas law doesn't give the judge the power to say, the mother just needs a couple more days. Can you keep her on life support while she gets used to the idea? So it's another case where a difficult law made things more difficult. But even with all of those worries, I think it's good to be an organ donor. But by all means, talk to your family about what you intend. Talk to your family about how serious you are about people not messing with your body to make the organs as good as possible for someone else. Talk about that. But then if you have a loved one whose organs could be used, they've been declared dead, you're satisfied that they're dead, let their organs be used to give other people life. Because it really is that for a lot of people. I have time to answer questions, having left everything perfectly clear. Or not. Claudia, did I come close to answering? Okay, good. Thank you. David.
Those situations and decisions about brain death is always assuming that somebody's on life support.
Oh, yes.
The brain's not, it's a good machine.
Right. So in the case of the girl in Texas, she has a tube doing the breathing for her, and she has a pacemaker making her heart beat. If you don't have a pacemaker and your heart's still beating, there's a part of your brainstem that's telling it to beat. And they should not be telling you that there's a... Now, if they're looking at a flat EEG and your heart's still beating, it's just curious. You just like, I'd like another EEG.
So, I don't know whether this eases or doesn't help consciences in these decisions or not, but when would we consider somebody to be dead? Your spirit departs from your body.
Right, well...
dead or when your heart stops?
I think you're dead when Jesus calls you home, which is really hard to detect empirically. No, it does turn out that we don't have the there, I hit the wrong thing. This irreversible cessation definition is the best that we're going to get, period, ever. So I I'm content that if your brain's not doing anything, you're never going to have, as far as we know, you don't even have an internal thought life. I don't know how that works. But I think we're permitted to treat the irreversible cessation of brain activity as death as well. This wasn't a question until the last 40 years. But part of the reason that this seems to me fairly important that we think through this, and I'm still thinking about it, is because medical technology is only going to get better. And what we can currently do to keep your heart and lung working, before long we're going to be able to do to keep your brain working. And so suppose somebody said, well, we can keep your heart and lung going indefinitely, and we'd like to keep your brain going. Just let us attach a cable back here, and we'll keep all the stuff going. We'll keep all the electrical activity functioning. then are we required to keep that on? Or what if we said, I know Joel's name, which is always a bad thing. So suppose Joel became very sick. I don't like this story. But suppose Pastor Mark became very, very sick. That's right. He becomes very, very sick, and his heart and lungs are okay, but his brain's clearly coming unglued, like more so than actually happening. coming unglued. And somebody offers him, so there are places, you know, where he could have his whole body frozen for the, against the day when then when we figure out how to fix him. But no, somebody says, no, we're not going to do that. All we're going to do is we're going to download your brain onto a hard drive. We're going to take the current neural, the current condition of your electrical network that is your brain, and we're going to superimpose it on another medium, like a block of silicone. It'll just sit there. And then later, when somebody else dies, we will, whose body's in good shape, like Chris Hemsworth dies, big surprise, but everything's fine about his body, and we're going to put Mark's brain into Chris Hemsworth's body. And we ask, so he revives and we say, who are you? He says, oh, I'm the pastor of Cornerstone Church. And it looks like Chris Hemsworth. now what? Well, so you're thinking, they can't do that. Correct, they can't yet. It isn't clear to me that they can't, period. If our thought processes are just entirely electrical events here, we could, in principle, imprint them somewhere else and transplant them into someone else, into a new host. This is my long-term fitness plan. I'm not going to stay fit. I'm going to impose all of my thought processes onto Chris Hemsworth, and then I will be fit. He's Thor, if you don't know what I'm talking about. He plays the character Thor. So it seems to me we need to have principles that can survive increases in technological capability, which is difficult. Question? Okay. Oh, I was going to be excited because I thought maybe you don't need Chris Hemsworth's body. You're fine. I need Chris Hemsworth's body. If you have other questions, I'm going to be hanging around. I'll be at the lunch this afternoon, so you can formulate your questions and jump me later. Let me pray to end. Dear God, we know that you are the Lord of our lives. And even though thinking about anyone's death, but especially our own, is difficult, we know that we belong to you. And that even as the world shrinks in horror at the idea of death, we know that it will be for us a deliverance, that we will be with you, that the troubles of this life will be over, that every tear will be wiped away, and that we will be yours forever. We ask that you would give us confidence, that you would give us hope, and that you would make us eager to tell others what a joy it is to walk with you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.